Constable Ichabod Crane, sent from New York to investigate murder in Sleepy Hollow.
How much of your superiors explained to you?
Only that the three were slain in open ground.
Now, this isn't going to be very helpful for you because Ichabod Crane is not a constable or an investigator of any sort in the actual textual material. He's a school teacher. But anyway, welcome to the show. This is the second of our Washington Irving episodes, the second story in the sketchbook of Jeffrey Crane, Gentleman.
If you couldn't get enough.
You could not get enough Washington Irving, although I think this will be enough, actually.
Some would say too much.
And so we're talking about Sleepy Hollow. You know, he does have two very, very famous stories. Sleepy Hollow.
Are these so you said that there's a number of tales and some are from Europe as well. Are these the only two tales that take place in America in this short story collection?
I don't know that they're the only ones, but if they aren't, there's only a few others. And the majority are like of Europe, as okay. I recall. And yeah, this takes place in Sleepy Hollow, New York, which the town wasn't actually called that at the time of this writing.
It's Tarrytown, yeah?
Yeah, originally North Tarrytown. Anyway, what were you saying?
I was reading some article that was like, Sleepy Hollow today saw some hard times after like the 2009 economic downturn, but it's still a great place for visitors and still pretty spooky.
Yeah, it's so depressing when the tourism boards have to depend on the ghost story element of...
I was just hoping they should be like, it's even more spooky with its like economic depression.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what really makes ghosts is economic anxiety.
Watch this Roth IRA disappear.
So yeah, Sleepy Hollow, the story of Ichabod Crane. We'll just give you a little bit into the setting of Sleepy Hollow. It's a very spooky place, as the story says itself. That wasn't created by the North Tarrytown Tourism Board. Here is a bit of that. By the way, I just do want to shout out Bob Neufeld, who's the LibriVox reader for this Sleepy Hollow version. Does a just incredible job reading. He sounds a bit like... that's not the best impression. It's like, I'm an old man with a very dignified voice. But he has a lot more gravitas than that. We're going to play it here. But I always do like the LibriVox volunteers, especially when they really... both really good at reading and two have good equipment.
Because we'll have to have a shit talking episode of the ones that are not good at it.
Yeah, no, there are some really bad ones. The all-star, the like Michael Jordan of LibriVox volunteer readers is Elizabeth Klett, though. She does like all the Jane Austen, all the...
Oh, yeah.
She does everything good. Anyway, this is Bob Neufeld, and we'll pick it up where he is talking about the spookiness... there's something in the air, or maybe in the water, of Sleepy Hollow that makes everyone just a sort of superstitious wreck. They also mention Henrik Hudson in this.
Such is the general purport of this legendary superstition, which has furnished materials for many a wild story in that region of shadows. And the specter is known at all the country firesides by the name of the Headless Horseman of Sleepy Hollow. It is remarkable that the visionary propensity I have mentioned is not confined to the native inhabitants of the valley, but is unconsciously imbibed by everyone who resides there for a time. However wide awake they may have been before they entered that sleepy region, they are sure, in a little time, to inhale the witching influence of the air and begin to grow imaginative, dream dreams, and see apparitions. I mention this peaceful spot with all possible laud, for it is in such little retired Dutch valleys, found here and there embosomed in the great state of New York, that population, manners, and customs remain fixed, while the great torrent of migration and improvement, which is making such incessant changes in other parts of this restless country, sweeps by them unobserved.
So, two things there. First, the most recent thing, the torrent of migration and improvement, gives us a little bit of a taste of what the sort of anti-capitalist conservatism was like pre-industrial revolution. It's upsetting order, basically, right? Like you have, it's bringing a whole bunch of people here. Improvements, that's a big buzzword for this time of American frontier colonialization. The reason we can take the land from the Indians is we're improving it. We're creating these improvements. There's a really funny thing. I think it's in... Alexis de Tocqueville, where he's talking about an improvement for the air being destroying trees. Like, if we chop these things down, it's better for the air.
The air has more room to grow.
And the other thing was that everyone, no matter who it is, you come to this little hollow and get sleepy. It's funny, you know, I neglected to say in the Rip Van Winkle episode that, you know, now if you go to sleep in 20 years, the Earth might not be there. You have this ecological change to this. It wouldn't just be the man-made things that were unchanged. You might actually have a completely different world. Every time somebody goes into this hollow, they start getting, like, paranoid. You might want to get the EPA on that, is all I'll say about that. And here is Ichabod himself.
In this byplace of nature, their abode in a remote period of American history, that is to say, some 30 years since, a worthy wight of the name of Ichabod Crane,
W-I-G-H-T,
sojourned, or as he expressed it, tarried in Sleepy Hollow for the purpose of instructing the children of the vicinity. He was a native of Connecticut, a state which supplies the Union with pioneers for the mind as well as for the forest, and sends forth yearly its legions of frontier woodmen and country schoolmasters. The cognomen of Crane was not inapplicable to his person. He was tall, but exceedingly lank, with narrow shoulders, long arms and legs, hands that dangled a mile out of his sleeves, feet that might have served for shovels, and his whole frame most loosely hung together. His head was small and flat at top, with huge ears, large green glassy eyes, and a long snipe nose, so that it looked like a weathercock perched upon his spindle neck to tell which way the wind blew. To see him striding along the profile of a hill on a windy day, with his clothes bagging and fluttering about him, one might have mistaken him for the genius of famine descending upon the earth, or some scarecrow eloped from a cornfield. His schoolhouse was a low building of one large room, rudely constructed of laws, the windows partly glazed and partly patched with leaves of old copybooks.
So what do you make of Ichabod as a teacher? That's one reason you would come to a new town, like you're a traveling teacher from Connecticut. Like,
well, so there's a setting, right, that there's a conflict going on already, where there are two worlds, that there's an older world and then there's this newer world that's modernity, but you can't really define what it is. It's just new, and it's wiping out this old world, right? And here comes this ambassador from Connecticut, which is immediately described as this, like, irascible march of progress, basically. That there, here's, like, one more person, and, like, this is what's going... This is, he's, like, shaping the new world just by showing up. Mm-hmm. And as you find out later on, that he may not actually be that harbinger of progress and reason and modernity that you think he is.
It's weird the way he's characterized. He's not just a nerdy teacher, right? He's a teacher who is also easily scared by tall tales and scary stories, but he's also has an incredible appetite, and he can't help but translate that into sort of an economic mindset where this abundance translates into like a, sort of a capitalist type of thing.
There's no curation in his diet, exemplified by how he... I think in most scenes he's eating, right? Like devouring food, but also like devouring knowledge, but can't discern knowledge of value with knowledge of no worth, which we can get into a little bit later.
Here he is. Here's a little bit from a bit later talking about this abundance mindset.
With his feet, and then generously calling his ever-hungry family of wives and children to enjoy the rich morsel which he had discovered.
Ichabod sets his eyes on Katrina Van Tassel, who is the daughter of one of the successful farm owners. And he wants to basically because of how much produce that farm is capable of putting out, he wants his daughter.
Yeah.
The pedagogue's mouth watered as he looked upon this sumptuous promise of luxurious winter fare. In his devouring mind's eye, he pictured to himself every roasting pig running about with a pudding in his belly and an apple in his mouth. The pigeons were snugly put to bed in a comfortable pie and tucked in with a coverlet of crust. The geese were swimming in their own gravy, and the ducks pairing cozily in dishes like snug married couples, with a decent competency of onion sauce. In the porkers, he saw carved out the future sleek side of bacon and juicy relishing ham. Not a turkey, but he beheld daintily trussed up, with its gizzard under its wing, and peradventure, a necklace of savory sausages. And even bright Chanticleer himself lay sprawling on his back, in a side dish, with uplifted claws, as if craving that quarter which his chivalrous spirit disdained to ask while living. As the enraptured Ichabod fancied all this, and as he rolled his great green eyes over the fat meadowlands, the rich fields of wheat, of rye, of buckwheat, and Indian corn, and the orchards burdened with ruddy fruit which surrounded the warm tenement of Fantassel, his heart yearned after the damsel who was to inherit these domains, and his imagination expanded with the idea how they might be readily turned into cash, and the money invested in immense tracts of wild land and shingle palaces in the wilderness. Nay, his busy fancy already realized his hopes, and presented to him the blooming Katrina, with a whole family of children, mounted on the top of a wagon loaded with household trumpery, with pots and kettles dangling beneath. And he beheld himself bestriding a pacing mare with a colt at her heels, setting out for Kentucky, Tennessee, or the Lord knows where.
It's so mercenary, and so, I mean, that's sort of what you expect of marriage at that time, right? The Jane Austen time period. You need the dowry, like, what's that dowry like? But it's just, it's so naked.
The emphasis on abundance, which I think is... If there is like such a contrast between then and now, like the quality of food I think about, but the idea of endless food or something, like even though I'm not making very much money at all right now, it's like that's not really something I'm like working towards. It's like, oh, I could have this much food.
Right. Yeah. The calories are not as hard to come by these days. So he has this sort of mindset, but he's also a teacher, and that sort of puts him in this interesting place in society with regards to the women folk. We're going to skip back a little bit.
But up until this point, he plays the type, right? He's a stranger who shows up to town, that this town has an older sense of itself, almost like a European sense of it. And here's this like hyper-capitalist person who's coming in, like evaluating who's the most valuable person. I'm this hyper-educated person. I'm going to go after this person.
It also shows, like, the women have a slightly different view of the men.
The schoolmaster is generally a man of some importance in the female circle of a rural neighborhood, being considered a kind of idle, gentlemanly personage of vastly superior taste and accomplishments to the rough country swains, and indeed inferior in learning only to the parson.
Rough Country Swain would be a good band name.
Yeah.
His appearance, therefore, is apt to occasion some little stir at the tea table of a farmhouse, and the addition of a supernumerary dish of cakes or sweetmeats, or peradventure, the parade of a silver teapot. Our man of letters, therefore, was peculiarly happy in the smiles of all the country damsels. How he would figure among them in the churchyard between services on Sundays, gathering grapes for them from the wild vines that overran the surrounding trees, reciting for their amusement all the epitaphs on the tombstones, or sauntering, with a whole bevy of them, along the banks of the adjacent mill pond, where the more bashful country bumpkins hung sheepishly back, envying his superior elegance and address.
The women are interested in him because he's cultured. That is a theme that will be in a lot of books I think we'll read.
Yeah, I think immediately think of Jefferson and Jefferson's relation with the wives of his friends, which is like supposedly he preferred discourse and dinner discourse with the wives of all these great men like John Adams or Madison. And he always considered himself like the most educated of anyone at the table. Mm. So it's like that trope, whatever that is, it's like that trope coming to life.
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily for the discourse. I think he likes the idea of that kind of archetype likes being thought of as intelligent.
Mm. Women as the channel for sort of intelligence, sort of loosely thought of, or information. The men are obviously working on more practical things, less gossip, but there's a sort of a teacher would have a cosmopolitan gloss just because of his profession, and that people would get excited by that. Like we said, like in the Sinclair Lewis, which we'll probably re-release that episode, there's the people who are sort of bookish have community, and that Washington Irving genders it is, I think, interesting. So let's introduce Katrina Van Tassel, who Ichabod has set his sights on here.
Among the musical disciples who assembled one evening each week to receive his instructions in psalmody was Katrina Van Tassel, the daughter and only child of a substantial Dutch farmer. She was a blooming lass of fresh 18, plump as a partridge, ripe and melting and rosy-cheeked as one of her father's peaches, and universally famed, not merely for her beauty, but her vast expectations. She was, withal, a little of a coquette, as might be perceived even in her dress, which was a mixture of ancient and modern fashion as most suited to set off her charms. She wore the ornaments of pure yellow gold which her great-great-grandmother had brought over from Sardam, the tempting stomacher of the olden time, and withal a provokingly short petticoat to display the prettiest foot and ankle in the country round.
Any sort of thought that I might have had that maybe Washington Irving was a closeted gay man in a time that wasn't hospitable to that, like that passage, I think, like, oh, yeah, I think he is straight.
Oh, you think so? It seems profoundly asexual.
The plot, I guess. Yeah, I'm just thinking of the way he objectifies it as food. That seems like, I guess, very heterosexual,
like,
to me.
For me, it's like the author is like veering off to like, oh, how do I talk about something I want to talk about?
I could see that. Yeah,
but I don't know. I feel like it's all like we're getting lost in intent, maybe, or at least I am. But it's like, it seems like a struggle to get out to describe her.
Yeah. Yeah. But he does definitely view her on his most like comfortable channel, which is that, or frequency, which is that this is sort of like she's abundance personified.
Yeah. A product or like a means to a product.
Right, exactly. And production, the reproduction, literally. Here is where he's got some rivals for Katrina Van Tassel.
Contrary, had to win his way to the heart of a country coquette, beset with a labyrinth of whims and caprices which were forever presenting new difficulties and impediments. And he had to encounter a host of fearful adversaries of real flesh and blood, the numerous rustic admirers who beset every portal to her heart, keeping a watchful and angry eye upon each other, but ready to fly out in the common cause against any new competitor. Among these, the most formidable was a burly, roaring, roistering blade of the name of Abraham, or according to the Dutch abbreviation, Bram Van Brunt, the hero of the country round, which rang with his feats of strength and hardihood. He was broad-shouldered and double-jointed, with short, curly black hair, and a bluff but not unpleasant countenance, having a mingled air of fun and arrogance. From his Herculean frame and great powers of limb, he had received the nickname of Bram Bones, by which he was universally known. He was famed for great knowledge and skill in horsemanship, being as dexterous on horseback as a Tartar. He was foremost at all races and cockfights, and with the ascendancy which bodily strength always acquires in rustic life, was the umpire in all disputes, setting his hat on one side and giving his decisions with an air and tone that admitted of no gainsay or appeal. He was always ready for either a fight or a frolic, but had more mischief than ill will in his composition, and with all his overbearing roughness, there was a strong dash of waggish good humor at bottom. He had three or four boon companions, who regarded him as their model, and at the head of whom he scoured the country, attending every scene of feud or merriment for miles around. In cold weather, he was distinguished by a fur cap, surmounted with a flaunting fox's tail. And when the folks at a country gathering descried this well-known crest at a distance, whisking about among a squad of hard riders, they always stood by for a squall. Sometimes his crew would be heard dashing along past the farmhouses at midnight, with hoop and halloo like a troop of Don Cossacks.
Interesting personification of Bram Van Brunt. Do you have any thoughts on him?
It's interesting that the metaphors used to describe him are steeped in old world phraseology and like place and location. That it makes you, as a reader, assume that this character, Abraham Van Brunt, is very much a product of the old European world. Without giving too much away, it's like, but he's ends up not being, basically.
Yeah, it's very, I don't know, it's hard to describe what, like, where does his character, like, what does his character become? It's not, is it really like the Harvey Birch leather stocking, or like what, it's not that, or like, I don't
he's
know.
He's like, he comes off as this inheritor of a European tradition, right? And that this Ichabod character is the new man, this new like educated man built in like the new world of like reason. But you find that those tropes are actually like inverted and their inheritance is the opposite.
So basically those two are the ones, Ichabod and Bram, mm-hmm. are competitive for Katrina Van Tassel. Ichabod gets invited to a play, basically a dance,
on her estate. Yeah,
yeah. And he's thinking like, this is gonna be it. And so let's go a little bit into that now. By the way, Washington Irving's terrible on race. We've heard a bit of his references to Indians earlier, but In Sleepy Hollow, he has one of Van Tassel's slaves come and deliver an invitation to come to this party, and the entire time he's just condescending about... actually, I might have it.
It's a bizarre addition.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, here it is.
Tent upon their books, or slyly whispering behind them with one eye kept upon the master, and a kind of buzzing stillness reigned throughout the schoolroom. It was suddenly interrupted by the appearance of a negro in tow-cloth jacket and trousers, a round-crowned fragment of a hat, like a cap of mercury, and mounted on the back of a ragged, wild, half-broken coat, which he managed with a rope by way of halter. He came clattering up to the school door with an invitation to Ichabod to attend a merrymaking, or quilting, frolic to be held that evening at Mynheer von Tassel's, and having delivered his message with that air of importance and effort at fine language which a negro is apt to display on petty embassies of the kind, he dashed over the brook and was seen scampering away up the hollow, full of the importance and hurry of his mission.
Just...
Why is that there, though? Yeah. I just, like... It's like he almost knows that, like, this is going to be a really incongruous thing to mention, so let me just take a paragraph here to bring this up for future readers.
Oh, yeah. Why would you think he'd think it's incongruous?
Because it's, like, it's a character that has nothing to do... has no real relation with any other character... but is given, like, an incredible amount of space that goes nowhere.
He's a vessel for information, and that in the story, the information is, well, come to this merrymaking, quilt-making party.
Yeah.
But the real information is the Van Tassels have slaves, and...
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It's a way of, like, telegraphing information that they're very wealthy.
Yeah, exactly. And it also, it might not be intentional. I don't think this is an implicit slavery critique, but it's interesting just to register how, like, the society worked. Like, that's insane. Like pre-post office, like, yeah, you just send your slave to go deliver the message.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's that small government that we need. In a world where you just send your slave to,
yeah, exactly.
to send notes.
Everyone has their own
fucking government getting in the way.
I like the libertarian thing where everyone has their own post office. And by a post office, they mean slave quarters. Like a special part of the slave quarters. It's very efficient. I want to go back to a part earlier where Ichabod, he goes to these meetings where they him and women often, they tell history and then ghost stories. And... after leaving these outings, Ichabod is sort of creeped out because it's sort of the witching hour. He's heading home late at night, and he sort of freaks himself out. And to sort of calm himself down, he starts singing to himself. That's why, like, Katrina Van Tassel is one of his singing students. Anyway, here's the part about that.
Then, as he wended his way by swamp and stream and awful woodland to the farmhouse where he happened to be quartered, every sound of nature at that witching hour fluttered his excited imagination. The moan of the whippoorwill from the hillside, the boding cry of the tree toad, that harbinger of storm, the dreary hooting of the screech owl, or the sudden rustling in the thicket of birds frightened from their roost. The fireflies, too, which sparkled most vividly in the darkest places, now and then startled him, as one of uncommon brightness would stream across his path. And if, by chance, a huge blockhead of a beetle came winging his blundering flight against him, the poor varlet was ready to give up the ghost with the idea that he was struck with a witch's token. His only resource on such occasions, either to drown thought or drive away evil spirits, was to sing psalm tunes, and the good people of Sleepy Hollow, as they sat by their doors of an evening, were often filled with awe at hearing his nasal melody in linked sweetness long drawn out, floating from the distant hill or along the dusky road. Another of his sources of fearful pleasure was to pass long winter evenings with the old Dutch wives, as they sat spinning by the fire with a row of apples roasting and spluttering along the hearth, and listened to their marvelous tales of ghosts and goblins and haunted fields and haunted brooks and haunted bridges and haunted houses, and particularly of the Headless Horseman, or Galloping Hessian of the Hollow, as they sometimes called him.
That the thing about singing scared is fascinating to me.
Well, yeah, that's so my question for you is, there, do you see any kind of implicit critique of Christianity and religion that... he's specifically known for singing the Psalms and always having, like, the Psalms with him, but also obsessed with, like, supernatural tales. Do you think that there's any connection that Irving is trying to elicit any kind of connection between superstition and, like, religious belief at this moment in time?
I don't think so. It's possible, I guess. I just don't, I haven't heard anything about Irving's beliefs on religion to think that. I mean, I found it interesting just on a psychological level of what do you do when you're creeped out, because, you know, that changes over the course of your lifetime. Obviously, you know, when you're very young, it's, well, do you have the door open or closed? You keep your closet door closed, like little like you have a nightlight on. I started listening to AM, FM, or FM radio on headphones when I was freaked out, listening to like just sports talk. Like by like fifth or sixth grade, if I was like, if you find yourself awake and everyone's asleep and you're just listening to your house being noisy and creepy, what do you do? And it's interesting to me that it would go to Psalms. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, but it's funny to me to imagine that that would calm somebody down, because I would not be calmed down by myself singing.
Well, that's, yeah. And that's what I thought in the story, is that there's like a relationship between his superstition and his, what he feels like is like warding off superstition, which is like this reading of the Psalms in a way that like most other characters and his antagonist in particular, Von Braun, he seems like a completely agnostic human being. You don't hear anything about his like religious belief. And so there's something about the Psalms being so specific to Ichabod Crane that he may actually be confusing the symptom with the disease.
I think there's definitely something to them using, like, his credulity is definitely his downfall here. I just don't know whether or not you can apply that to the religion part of it.
Yeah.
I don't know if Irving would have thought like that. But I mean, it's definitely there if you want it.
Mm-hmm.
So Irving Ichabod goes to this dance and he dances around. Here's how the party goes.
The lady of his heart was his partner in the dance, and smiling graciously in reply to all his amorous oglings, while Brom Bones, sorely smitten with love and jealousy, sat brooding by himself in one corner. When the dance was at an end, Ichabod was attracted to a knot of the sager folks, who, with old Von Tassel, sat smoking at one end of the piazza, gossiping over former times and drawing out long stories about the war. This neighborhood, at the time of which I am speaking, was one of those highly favored places which abound with chronicle and great men. The British and American line had run near it during the war. It had, therefore, been the scene of marauding.
Okay, so they have a good dance, and it doesn't end. You know, Ichabod thinks he's really in there. You know, Brahms looking on. Ichabod's dancing like crazy. He's a really good dancer, apparently. But here's how the party actually ends.
The revel now gradually broke up. The old farmers gathered together their families in their wagons and were heard for some time rattling along the hollow roads and over the distant hills. Some of the damsels mounted on pillions behind their favorite swains, and their light-hearted laughter, mingling with the clatter of hoofs, echoed along the silent woodlands, sounding fainter and fainter until they gradually died away. And the late scene of noise and frolic was all silent and deserted. Ichabod only lingered behind, according to the custom of country lovers, to have a tete-a-tete with the heiress, fully convinced that he was now on the high road to success. What passed at this interview I will not pretend to say, for in fact I do not know. Something, however, I fear me, must have gone wrong, for he certainly sallied forth after no very great interval, with an air quite desolate and chapfallen. Oh, these women! These women! Could that girl have been playing off any of her coquettish tricks? Was her encouragement of the poor pedagogue all a mere sham to secure her conquest of his rival? Heaven only knows, not I. Let it suffice to say, Ichabod stole forth with the air of one who had been sacking a hen roost, rather than a fair lady's heart.
Yeah, so bummer, man. The dancing and being the singing teacher and the schoolmaster, not enough to pull Katrina Van Tassel.
But that's a reversal, right? Where he's no longer this hyper-aware, hyper-intelligent outsider. Now he's behind on, like, certain social norms. And it, like, leaves a space for... I just feel like reading it, you're just assuming that, like, this guy knows how modernity works and how, like, the new world operates.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's this moment right here where it's like, oh, maybe he doesn't. And this, like, who's considered a yokel, this Von Braun.
Right.
Actually, he has a much more, like, intuitive sense of how people work. And from this point on, it's what makes it, like, an actual quality piece of literature.
Right.
It subverts expectations in a really interesting way.
It is. Yeah, yeah. Let's get to... So basically, after this party and this tete-a-tete, as he calls it.
Your coquettish ways.
Goddamn coquettes.
Which we now call, like, I don't know, bitchery.
Yeah, what is the...
Coquette is definitely a word.
Ichabod's sort of friend-zoned here. just to translate it into modern parlance. She's like flirty, but like, yeah, I just want to, like, I just like your singing lessons. And you know what? Guess what? There's a professional imbalance there, Ichabod. You better like not try to fuck all your
yeah, that's super
singing students.
Up.
Come on, man. Anyway.
Her age is explicitly stated, but no one else's is.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But interesting, it's weird. Just one more nail in the coffin of Irving's understanding of women.
Okay, so yeah, that doesn't go well. And then not only does he get sort of blown out by this woman he's thought he was in with, he's also freaked out because the people were telling ghost stories at that party too. And yeah. Now he has to,
which, who among us,
now he has to ride home alone,
yeah, hoping to get laid, and you just got caught up in the ghost stories,
which this is actually part where I found psychologically unreal, because if I've ever gotten my like heart broken, I'm not worried about supernatural shit at that moment. Like, that's the last time I'm
well,
like,
I guess that's just your experience.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just feel like the more immediate concerns sort of leave the more abstract things out the window. But anyway, here is the climactic meeting with the headless horseman.
And heel upon the starveling ribs of old Gunpowder, who dashed forward, snuffling and snorting, but came to stand just...
Gunpowder's his horse.
...who bestowed both whip and heel upon the starveling ribs of old Gunpowder, who dashed forward, snuffling and snorting, but came to stand just by the bridge, with a suddenness that nearly sent his rider sprawling over his head. Just at this moment, a plashy tramp by the side of the bridge caught the sensitive ear of Ichabod. In the dark shadow of the grove, on the margin of the brook, he beheld something huge, misshapen, and towering. It stirred not, but seemed gathered up in the gloom, like some gigantic monster ready to spring upon the traveler. The hair of the affrighted pedagogue rose upon his head with terror. What was to be done? To turn and fly was now too late. And besides, what chance was there of escaping ghost or goblin, if such it was, which could ride upon the wings of the wind? Summoning up, therefore, a show of courage, he demanded in stammering accents, "Who are you?" He received no reply. He repeated his demand in a still more agitated voice. Still, there was no answer. Once more he cudgeled the sides of the inflexible Gunpowder, and shutting his eyes, broke forth with involuntary fervor into a psalm tune. Just then, the shadowy object of alarm put itself in motion, and with a scramble and a bound, stood at once in the middle of the road. Though the night was dark and dismal, yet the form of the unknown might now in some degree be ascertained.
He starts singing, and that is, like you flagged earlier, his singing is what calls the headless horseman to attention, like, oh, I'm aware of you now.
Mm-hmm.
He appeared to be a horseman of large dimensions and mounted on a black horse of powerful frame. He made no offer of molestation or sociability, but kept aloof on one side of the road, jogging along on the blind side of old Gunpowder, who had now got over his fright and waywardness. Ichabod, who had no relish for this strange midnight companion, and bethought himself of the adventure of Brom Bones with the galloping Hessian, now quickened his steed in hopes of leaving him behind. The stranger, however, quickened his horse to an equal pace. Ichabod pulled up and fell into a walk, thinking to lag behind. The other did the same. His heart began to sink within him. He endeavored to resume his psalm tune, but his parched tongue clove to the roof of his mouth, and he could not utter a stave.
That reminds me about a time where I'll just say Tyler, we both know him.
Future guest.
Future literary hangover crew member. I saw him driving down Main Street in Moorhead, Minnesota, when we were in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled up right next to him and just stared at him, like, just looked over next to him and could see him sort of like, he noticed the car was there, so I kept like goosing the accelerator a little bit. So
nice.
I like, and we went about four blocks before he like looked over at
Jesus Christ.
Hilarious. Anyway, that's what that part reminded me of. Hi, Tyler.
There was something in the moody and dogged silence of this pertinacious companion that was mysterious and appalling. It was soon fearfully accounted for. On mounting a rising ground which brought the figure of his fellow traveler in relief against the sky, gigantic in height and muffled in a cloak, Ichabod was horror-struck on perceiving that he was headless. But his horror was still more increased on observing that the head, which should have rested on his shoulders, was carried before him on the pommel of his saddle. His terror rose to desperation.
One thing people should know about is it does mention a pumpkin. Pumpkin gets thrown at Ichabod. That's what's there after they find him. But jack-o'-lanterns themselves were not in America. They were brought over by the Irish during the potato famine.
So interesting.
It's anachronistic that to include this story with a jack-o'-lantern. And here's the climactic part where Ichabod gets killed by the horseman.
Just then, he heard the black steed panting and blowing close behind him. He even fancied that he felt its hot breath. Another convulsive kick in the ribs, and old Gunpowder sprang upon the bridge. He thundered over the resounding planks. He gained the opposite side. And now Ichabod cast a look behind to see if his pursuer should vanish, according to rule, in a flash of fire and brimstone. Just then he saw the goblin rising in his stirrups, and in the very act of hurling his head at him. Ichabod endeavored to dodge the horrible missile, but too late. It encountered his cranium with a tremendous crash. He was tumbled headlong into the dust, and Gunpowder, the black steed, and the goblin rider passed by like a whirlwind.
Pretty gruesome way to, like, you think you got him, and then he just throws his head at you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, details smashing against his own body.
And here's the speculation before we speculate ourselves on what actually, in fact, happened to Rip Van Winkle, or what actually happened to Ichabod Crane.
The school was removed to a different quarter of the hollow, and another pedagogue reigned in his stead. It is true, an old farmer who had been down to New York on a visit several years after, and from whom this account of the ghostly adventure was received, brought home the intelligence that Ichabod Crane was still alive, that he had left the neighborhood, partly through fear of the goblin and Hans von Ripper, and partly in mortification at having been suddenly dismissed by the heiress, that he had changed his quarters to a distant part of the country, had kept school and studied law at the same time, had been admitted to the bar, turned politician, electioneered, written for the newspapers, and finally had been made a justice of the 10-pound court. Brown Bones, too, who, shortly after his rival's disappearance, conducted the blooming Katrina in triumph to the altar, was observed to look exceedingly knowing whenever the story of Ichabod was related, and always burst into a hearty laugh at the mention of the pumpkin, which led some to suspect that he knew more about the matter than he was related, and always burst into a hearty laugh at the mention of the pumpkin, which led some to suspect that he knew more about the matter than he chose to tell. The old country wives, however, who are the best judges of these matters, maintain to this day that Ichabod was spirited away by supernatural means. And
So there's another look at sort of the two audiences Irving writes for. It's a really haunting story, though, because I think the most likely scenario is Von Brom killed him.
Yeah.
And, like, that knowing look that, like, why would you include that?
Yeah.
If not that. And then to move on from that, which I think is the real, like, homicidal explanation, let's look at the village women who say, you know, that this is the ghosts, right?
Well, I think it moves past the idea, like, it's irrelevant to this story whether he lives or dies, right, Crane? It's more important that he was beaten by this other person for the hand of this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I don't know. I just had this reading of who's the modern man, who's like the new man. And you think it's Crane, and he comes to this like backwoods, heavily Dutch neighborhood. Sorry, village. And he gets bested by Von Braun. And he has like a more innate sense, modern sensibility than Crane, and uses his superstition against him, get the woman and to like breed on, and like in this almost like Darwinian sense. And it has this kind of almost parable sense of how modernity works, which is it doesn't follow through location and it doesn't follow through bloodlines. It's only like this sense of cunning that lets you get ahead and take advantage of like other people.
I also see it as a more how we hide criminality and criminality that the sort of society accepts. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just imagine this was a murder of the teacher because over a romantic rivalry. Mm-hmm. It's really chilling because the entire society is just like, whatever. Like, he didn't owe anybody any debts. He wasn't like a family man. Who gives a shit what literally happened to him? That you would sort of joke about it, and it would be that Van Tassel, that Katrina and Von Braun would go get married right after that. That would be the how they respond to Ichabod dying.
Yeah,
it's very dark that a society would like. This is what pisses me off about. Let's play this official trailer of this Fox Sleepy Hollow thing from. This is from 2013.
Yeah.
Because the actual story is way creepier than how they keep trying to morph it into a detective drama.
Yeah.
My name is Ichabod Crane. I was enlisted under the command of General Washington.
General George Washington.
Do you know him?
It was 250 years ago. Welcome to the 21st century, Mr. Crane.
Few know the real legend of Sleepy Hollow. But buried in the secret history of our nation...
Washington gave me a mission to kill a man.
...lies the truth.
Would you admit to cutting off his head?
First I shot him. Beheading him seemed the next logical step.
People keep going to Sleepy Hollow producers because it's a name that connotes creepiness, right?
Yeah.
Like, that is as Halloween a name as you can get is Sleepy Hollow. Because that in the Headless Horseman myth. But the actual story of a community that decides, like, death can occur. This person can be killed. I mean,
If you don't pass a number of social norms, essentially. This is this outsider who didn't congeal very well with the community, so he's disposable.
But he gels in certain ways, right? Like,
I thought all of his attributes were considered eccentric, essentially. Like, there's never a moment where he seems to be fitting in.
A bit much, yeah. And it's even true, like, in the last scene where he's in the schoolhouse, like, right before the Van Tassel's slave comes and invites him to the merrymaking, his students are sort of uneasy and not really, they're buzzing with sort of some, well, actually, I want to play that, go back to that once more, because I think that's my conspiratorial reading, is the kids know that this guy's going to be killed.
He's been one of, like, many teachers or something?
Or, like, yeah, many outside, like, yeah, guys that get too big for their britches. Let's see here.
In this way, matters went on for some time, without producing any material effect on the relative situations of the contending powers. On a fine autumnal afternoon, Ichabod, in pensive mood, sat enthroned on the lofty stool from whence he usually watched all the concerns of his little literary realm. In his hand he swayed a ferrule, that scepter of despotic power. The birch of justice reposed on three nails behind the throne, a constant terror to evildoers, while on the desk before him might be seen sundry contraband articles and prohibited weapons, detected upon the persons of idle urchins, such as half-munched apples, pop-guns, whirligigs, fly-cages, and whole legions of rampant little paper gamecocks.
Weapons he's confiscated from these kids.
Apparently there had been some appalling act of justice recently inflicted, for his scholars were all busily intent upon their books, or slyly whispering behind them with one eye kept upon the master, and a kind of buzzing stillness reigned throughout the schoolroom.
So what if the act of justice that he says has just recently been committed that they're all buzzing about is one that's about to happen?
Oh. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's my reading of this. If I was to restage The Legend of Sleepy Hollow for a modern audience, it would be someone like comes to town as a teacher into a small town and seemingly getting along with everybody, but everyone basically decides like he doesn't fit here.
Right. Yeah, that's like a horror story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Very spooky. Very spooky stuff.
There's an excerpt of it when I was reading that really stood out. For me, which is when Irving describes the town of Sleepy Hollow as filled with men that have tall tales of bravery, and links that with ghost stories, that all these men have stories about the revolution. This is like a post like immediately after the Revolutionary War, and all these men have these stories of how they like, you know, killed 10,000 men or whatever, or like saved their entire battalion or whatever. And there was this particular moment where it says like ghost stories thrived in like isolated Dutch communities because people knew those ghosts. Like they knew them when they were alive, basically.
So yeah, this is at the merrymaking, and they've moved on from dancing to telling ghost stories and or war stories and then ghost stories.
Mm-hmm.
Of every exploit, there was the story of Dofoe Martling, the large blue-bearded Dutchman who had nearly taken a British frigate with an old iron 9-pounder from a mud breastwork, only that he has gone burst at the 6th discharge. And there was the old gentleman who shall be nameless, being too rich a mind hair to be lightly mentioned, who, in the Battle of White Plains, being an excellent master of defense, parried a musket ball with a small sword, insomuch that he absolutely felt it whiz round the blade and glance off at the hilt, in proof of which he was ready at any time to show the sword with the hilt a little bent. There were several more that had been equally great in the field, not one of whom but was persuaded that he had a considerable hand in bringing the war to a happy termination. But all these were nothing to the tales of ghosts and apparitions that succeeded. The neighborhood is rich in legendary treasures of the kind. Local tales and superstitions thrive best in these sheltered, long-settled retreats, but are trampled underfoot by the shifting throng that forms the population of most of our country places. Besides, there is no encouragement for ghosts in most of our villages, for they have scarcely had time to finish their first nap and turn themselves in their graves before their surviving friends have traveled away from the neighborhood, so that when they turn out at night to walk their rounds, they have no acquaintance left to call upon. This is perhaps the reason why we so seldom hear of ghosts, except in our long-established Dutch communities.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
I like the poetic reasoning of, well, no one knows the ghost, so they disappear.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like one more illustration of this kind of old, almost European way of life that's being smashed out by this more reasonable, logical modernity that you think is Ichabod Crane, but it's not. It's actually Bones Van Braun.
Yeah, it's very metaphorical that, you know, you don't stay in a place long enough for it to haunt you.
Yeah. Or like what you were talking about, like kind of situating itself between two worlds. Mm-hmm. You know, like I feel like this implicitly, like this text is talking about this kind of like old world superstition that's being wiped out. And it only lives on in like the minds of the foolish.
Yeah, but it's still definitely like actionable on a society level.
Yeah, but people take advantage of that, basically,
right?
To get the girl, like for very materialistic ends.
Yes, exactly. It's like it's all about it's political, really, what these things sort of represent. And yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I actually really like the double reading of, like, we're gonna gloss over this fact that this was just a murder in a small town. And a lot of people probably knew that what happened about it, and they basically scared this guy to death.
Mm-hmm.
And still allow it to be a supernatural story, which is how I think people still think of it and have always thought about it.
Yeah.
On a popular level. Like this is a ghost story. Anyway.
I think there's also a reading of Irving's contemporary world, if you look at the literary movement at the time, which would be like European Romanticism, which was steeped in ghosts and otherworldly concepts. And Irving essentially has a pretty stark, ironic detachment from it. That's like, this is ridiculous. And it'd be ridiculous if you would fall for it in a way that I feel like Shelley, Keats, and Byron would never be that detached. Like they would see themselves, they would make Ichabod Crane this like misunderstood genius rather than essentially an oaf.
Right. And it's funny because they actually were fans of his, or some of those people.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I mean, I think everyone was sort of friends. It was such a small community then that like clashes over form and theory weren't really at the forefront. They're just like were writers.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about particularly like English Romantic movement and then how it transmuted into America, because that Gulf of the Atlantic Ocean is still so vast at that time that it really does seem like almost a completely independent literary scene, but with like certain aspects of it which make them both cousins.
Yeah, let's go a little bit into, just to wrap up, this is from this Brian J. Jones, New York Public New York Society Library talk from 2010. He's a biographer of Irving. And this talks about success following the publication of the sketchbook.
So the image management begins now. Irving's friend, the artist Charles Leslie, begins working on a portrait of Irving, and Irving was adamant that Leslie not paint him in clothing that might in a few years, and this is Irving's word, I love this, appear stupid. Irving writes and says, no Venetian cloaks or capes in corners and angles, but rather let the costume be simple and picturesque, but such a one as a gentleman might be supposed to wear occasionally at the present day. So Irving's smashed, but the pressure of success is almost more than he can handle. He's desperate now for a follow-up. His publisher is pressing him to go again. Well, Irving develops a massive case of writer's block now. So he travels all over Europe trying to shake his writer's block, settle down, find inspiration. He continues to be feted wherever he goes, and he's also broke. He had a knack for making poor investments. He's lost a lot of his money on a risky steamboat endeavor. Most of these endeavors were encouraged by his brother Peter. But Irving knew his name was enough to sell. He said, any book I should now offer for sale, good or bad, would be sure to find a ready publisher at a high price among the booksellers. And he was right. The follow-up book, finally, Bracebridge Hall, which he also released under the Jeffrey Crayon name, was a hit, and Irving basked in another round of success. He's now officially the writer of note. His name and influence can make or break a book. In 1822, he's approached by an American publisher in London who's looking for help in securing a British publisher for a book he just published. It's a Revolutionary War era espionage novel called The Spy. It's written by a 32-year-old New Yorker named James Fenimore Cooper. So Irving goes to John Murray, and to his annoyance, Murray says no. Well, nonetheless, Cooper sends Irving a note of thanks, and then asks Irving help for securing help with another book he's got called The Pioneers, which is the first book in the Leatherstocking Tales. Well, this time, Murray's a little more impressed, and at Irving's behest, agrees to publish Cooper's novel. This marks the beginning of a professional relationship between Irving and Cooper that would swing between warm and absolutely frigid over the next four decades.
Yeah, I just thought that was a bit interesting how small the circles
are
that they run in. But any final thoughts on Irving and Sleepy Hollow?
I just think it's just like a solid short story for something that essentially is like considered for kids or almost just like American folklore. Like, it's a great piece of literature.
It's much better than I expected.
Yeah, it's complex and it's unclear. And I love the idea that Irving was confident enough not to just say, Brahms did it.
Right.
To leave it.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it's, he did.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of that. And the narrator at the end, which I feel like is almost another discussion on its own. But the idea of the narrator's like, none of this is true.
Yeah, yeah.
Which rules. And it takes place in the middle of Manhattan.
And it's funny that like doing all those sorts of things, which like maybe we're tired of now. But like doing those originally or early on as like when they were actually experiments. I was more impressed with Washington Irving. His reputation isn't much. You'll commonly come across that when you talk about Irving scholarship. Like he's at a low ebb. Mainly a lot of the things because he has a very limited scope of experience that he's able to like talk about, and particularly when it comes to things that aren't in like slavery or the Native American don't have a huge part in they're very ancillary and like incidental to his stories. But as an imaginative writer, the Rip Van Winkle was I thought more interesting to me than I thought. There's a lot of weird details, a lot of interesting details about the passage of time and unsettling sort of creepy folktale-ish things that weren't in the original that he was basing it off of. And Sleepy Hollow, the characters are very interesting. I think they're almost allowed to be more interesting because they're before certain stereotypes of what the teacher or what the sort of like what maleness is. The role of a male, it's ironic we have all this crisis now of like what's a male to do in today's society. Well, we've been fucking focusing our publishing toward that question for like 200 years.
Yeah.
And that shows in both of Rip Van Winkle and Sleepy Hollow, the models of male adulthood there are very varied and I think interesting in ways that...
And in conflict with each other.
Yes. And representative of... They're sort of archetypes that never became the archetypes. Right.
Yeah, that's true. They're all like drafts. Yeah, like a collection of early drafts of things that become much more familiar.
Yeah. All right. Well, that will, I think, do it for this edition of The Literary Hangover. Alex, I want to thank you again for joining me.
Yeah, it was great.
And we will be back in a couple of weeks.